On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the Army steals a bunch of software, we make money faster than the speed of light, and Glenn Evans tells us all about the future of networking. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 69, recorded December 2nd, 2013. Glenn Evans and the future of networking. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by TechServe. TechServe assists U.S. businesses of all sizes with their technology needs, including Apple, Avid, Adobe, and HP solutions. Visit techserve.com/twiet and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs in RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to TWiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And of course, I'm joined by my spectacular cast of cohorts, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise from the University of Hawaii. Brian, so good to see you. And, well, happy post-Turkey Day thing.
Happy post-steak day. But hey, what the heck?
That's right. In Hawaii, you eat steak.
Or something. You know. I sometimes question, I love the holiday, but, you know, are we celebrating the right thing? Because the American Indians kind of got a raw deal out of that whole thing. And, you know, I got to say a shout out to my American Indian friends that maybe you should boycott Thanksgiving, but help us out on the economy on Black Friday.
Oh, Chibert, I think you're just having disgruntled stones here because, well, your island itself was annexed by the United States. But we'll come back to that later. Let's talk to Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, so good to see you in the, what looks like the sunny east. How could this be?
Well, down here in Florida, it is indeed sunny. And just wanted to let you know that when it comes to annexation, we're celebrating the 500th anniversary of Europeans coming in and doing what they did so well for so long here in the land of flowers. But it's a good day. It's in the 70s. It's a fine day to be right here on TWiet with the TWiet Riot.
Wow, we really started off the show on a downer. We just kind of passed judgment on entire generations of people. But that's okay, because that's kind of what we do here. Now, on this show, we've got a special treat for you. We're going to be bringing in special guest Mr. Glenn Evans, the lead engineer of Interop. But we're not going to do that right now. Right now, it's all about the Enterprise Byte. And let's start off with story one. This is actually pretty big. This has a lot of implications for any enterprise user, any enterprise administrator, even any enterprise exec. And that is that the United States Army was caught pirating about $180 million in software. This story comes from the Washington Post, among other sources, talking about how in 2004, the Army brought in a company called Aptricity to help them with logistics. Now, Aptricity made a suite of software that use a series of servers and a series of clients to give real-time information about the movement of any sorts of units, anything from supply trucks to military units to caravans. It was a very useful function, a useful feature that the Army wanted to play with. So in 2004, they contracted with Aptricity to give them that solution on a limited basis. They paid $4.5 million, and that licensed them for 3 server licenses and 500 named user licenses. Now, the original terms of the deal was that it would be $1,350,000 for every server license, $5,000 for each client device license. That's a license that works on a device, no matter who's using that device, and $1,000 for each separate named user client. That's a license that works with one person and one person alone. That's fine. That's normal. That's what happens. The Army tests out the solution. The problem is they like the solution so much that they installed it on everything without paying Aptricity. Chibert, let me kick this off to you first. In 2009, the government expanded the purchase program to two more server licenses, so up to five, 150 device licenses, and 1,000 additional named user licenses. But the story talks about how the Army installed it on more than 100 servers and 9,000-plus devices. This is gross license infringement, right?
Well, yeah, there's no question about it. And, you know, hey, you vote with your dollars. So if you buy it, you're supporting the company and you're supporting changes, you're supporting upgrades. Now, here's the problem. A lot of people that are working in the defense industry, especially if they're in uniform, have the kind of the attitude that the mission is all important. Get it done no matter what. Even if right now I don't have the money, let's just get it done. It's an admirable attitude because I like the let's get it done attitude. But sometimes intellectual property rights get trampled in there. And when the story says reverse engineered things, which is starting to get a little ahead of ourselves, keep in mind a lot of the purchase agreements, a lot of the large-scale contracts that the military does, they reserve the right for defense-sensitive technology to be able to create it in times of war. And technically, we're currently at war. So has it, you know, it's really, 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 really dark gray. But can it be argued? That's my big question.
Right.
I still say they should pay for it, but you know, there I can see how it can happen.
Right. Let me throw this over to you, Curtis, because right now the chat room is kind of going crazy, saying, "Well, the Army should be using open source. Why don't they support it themselves? Why don't they build their own solution?" Those are all valid points, but that's not what we're talking about right now. What we're talking about is something the Army did that I believe most enterprise managers, most IT managers are familiar with, because you're always running into this in the enterprise. Even the most policy stringent, even the most compliant enterprises are occasionally going to run afoul of licensing. Let's talk a little bit about the terms of the licensing. As I mentioned, it was $1.3 million for every license for a server, $5,000 for every client device, and $1,000 for every named user license. Is that high? Is that low? I mean, I know it's a military project, but even for something as useful as a logistics, that seems to be a little in the gold brick range, yeah?
Well, it does indeed sound expensive, but then again, I think you could make the case that there is other software that is very mission-specific in other areas that is probably priced in similar ways. My suspicion is that once you get into things like some of the medical licenses, some of the bio fields, biotechnology fields, and probably some of the stuff in areas like energy exploration, you're going to see some pretty high per seat costs. So while it's very high, is it unheard of? No. The thing that we don't know is whether all of this happened because of a positive decision by someone, that there was an officer somewhere, or a group of officers, who said, "Hey, we've got this software, let's steal it. Let's just put it out everywhere and dare them to catch it." Or did it happen the way this happens in so many organizations, where you have one guy who says to his buddy, "You know, there's this software that really works great, and we've got a server license, so let me just give it to you. We're covered." It might well have been covered for the first few named seats. They probably overbought a little bit, but it didn't take long for it to spiral out of control. We don't know right now, at least based on what we've seen, which case it was. Was it maliciousness? Was it mere oversight laxity in a huge organization? Either way, the fact is that the military should have gone back and cleaned up after it was over with. Unfortunately, the military doesn't have a great track record in cleaning up after itself. And I say that as someone who lives in a state where there are still schools that have to be closed once in a while because they find live ordnance buried in the sand out in the playground. This is not unheard of, and it's unfortunate regardless of whether you're talking about software or things that go boom in the night.
I want to go back over to you, Chubert, because working at a university, you run into software compliance all the time. I mean, it's in academia, it could be even worse than what we saw in the Army. Now, in this particular case, I should mention that Aptricity asked for $24 million. They got a $50 million judgment, which seems not all that much considering the fact that they pirated $180 million worth of software. But let's get past that and talk about how this noncompliance worked. Because in this case, when the Army was warned internally that they could be out of compliance for the software, they actually hired a contractor called Future Research Corporation of Huntsville to reverse engineer the software solution so that they could say, well, we own our own solution. This doesn't actually belong to Aptricity. That sounds horrendous, but it could be even worse in the enterprise, right? I've heard stories. I've been part of tales in which a large, not the 10,000-seat enterprise, but a large enterprise has realized how out of compliance it is with a particular set of software tools, realized how much it's going to cost, and then got into the stalemate of, well, we're not going to report ourselves, so what's the harm, what's the foul? This is sort of a hard thing to self-report, right? I mean, you don't want to tell the software company that, yeah, we're out of compliance, we want to be in compliance. You're going to try to find a way out of it first.
Okay, so you've actually brought up two interesting points. First off, the article says reversed engineered, but I'm not sure that's really true. I was involved in a couple of things where there were solutions that looked good, but they weren't quite what we needed. So we bought it as a stopgap, and then we, in parallel, started a program to custom engineer something that actually did meet our needs. But because of the new COTS and GOTS, well, not new, but the COTS and GOTS policies, you have to at least try commercial off the shelf or government off the shelf before you can justify a stovepipe or custom application. That might have been what happened, not necessarily reverse engineer. It's just someone probably borrowed a heck of a lot of features from the commercial software for writing the bid specs. Now, to answer the question about academia, academia is one of those weird places where it's got two faces. The most academic institutions are really, really down on departments and faculty and staff pirating software to the point where there are quite a few audits. Now, the problem comes up not so much in the faculty and staff, even though it still happens. It's with the students. Students typically don't have as much money as they would like, and they have friends that might have been able to go in BitTorrent broken copies where the licensing has been disabled. We try to discourage that, and we are constantly getting warning letters, you know, for different people, especially if, you know, these kids are distributing it. So it is a academic policy to be good, but it's really hard to keep up, especially when you have people that, you know, they got to use it for their classes, but yet they don't have enough bucks to pay for it.
Well, you know what, you two? I believe that we have stumbled into a bigger issue, a bigger item here. We're going to have to bring in someone who's an expert in software management and software compliance, because I think this is actually a problem that is much more prevalent in the enterprise than most of us are willing to admit. Most of us are current on licenses for the operating system and maybe even Office, maybe even the productivity tools. But it always seems that there's that software suite that goes underneath the radar, that gets installed on way too many computers and becomes part of the business, even though we're not paying for it. So we'll bring that to you in a future episode of Twilight. But right now, I want to move on to the second enterprise bite, and that's all about making money faster than the speed of light. At least the speed of light through fiber. This one comes from the LA Times, talking about how Ari Rubenstein, who's the global head of commercial products for Strike Technologies, has been racing to build an ultra-fast microwave radio transmitter network that links financial hubs. Now, currently, he has one that's running from the top of the NASDAQ stock exchange from New Jersey over to Chicago. Now, the reason why he's doing this is because the speed of light is not constant. At least it's not constant across different types of medium. The speed of light through water is different than the speed of light through a vacuum, which is different than the speed of light through air of different densities, which is different than the speed of light through glass, which is fiber optics. Now, when light runs through glass, it runs about 65% of the speed of light in a vacuum, whereas when it runs through a microwave transmitter network, it can run up to 95% the speed of light in a vacuum. What does that mean for that length that goes 734 miles from Chicago to New Jersey? Well, if I do my math really quick, that means that from Chicago to New Jersey over glass, over fiber, it's going to take almost 6 seconds. It's about 5 point something milliseconds, whereas over a microwave length, that will take 4.1 milliseconds. It doesn't sound like a lot, but Chiebert, what does that 1 millisecond difference mean in practical terms?
That 1 millisecond, if you're doing something, say, like program trading, could represent millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars if, say, for instance, You're trading based on the stock slide of a big corporation, you know, if you're shorting them or something like that. Just keep in mind, the stock trading, the securities companies are so worried about milliseconds. They're actually worried about nanoseconds in some cases that they're not using regular Ethernet anymore. They're actually using fiber channel, for God's sakes, because they want faster and faster ability to do trading. So while that microwave sounds good, gee, what would happen if you could send it over a vacuum tube, you know, maybe shoot it across, you know, town or something, use those old vacuum tubes that like they have in Chicago, put a better seal on them and shoot lasers. You know, that might be even faster. I don't know. I'm starting to get silly here. But, you know, the index of refraction is there on purpose because it shows you a multiplying factor on how much of a fraction of the speed of light in vacuum can this particular material do. In fact, it is the basis on why fiber optics work, because you're creating a tube of pure glass surrounded by impure glass, and that changes the index of refraction, creates a mirror. So that's kind of what the physics looks like when we're starting to talk about this story.
Right, right. Curtis, let me go over to you. I think this story actually started about a year ago when we were talking about how a bank, a private bank, had purchased its own fiber link across the Atlantic. They actually paid $1 point something billion for a company to lay down a link that would be used by them and them alone. At the time, it seemed ridiculous that anyone would do that, that a private corporation would do that, because the outlay was so incredible. But they earned that back in, I think it was a month, because they got their data just a few milliseconds faster than everyone else who was transiting the public internet, the public connection across the Atlantic. And what they determined was, as Chiebert said, when you're using these software trade systems that are operating on the nanosecond, a millisecond here or there translates into billions and billions of dollars in profit. My question to you, though, is these faster connections, they really only make sense for those financial institutions that are trading down at the nanosecond, right? The rest of us really don't care.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. When you're doing high-frequency trading, this sort of thing matters a great deal. And the thing is, it matters because not only is the connection speed faster, but the gain speed in other ways as well. Let's remember, these are absolutely private networks. That means that there's a great deal of the security overhead that goes on for transactions that go across the internet isn't required. In many cases, they are using non-standard networking protocols that have lower overhead than regular run-of-the-mill commercial networks do. They pick speed everywhere they can because they really are trading at incredibly high frequency, incredibly high speed, and doing it so frequently that making a fraction of a cent on each transaction adds up to billions of dollars in a very short period of time.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's Curtis Franklin, and thank you for making the point about faster internet connectivity. We'll get right back with them, but Chiebert, I want to go back over to you, because we've got people in the chat room saying, well, couldn't they use microwave for these transatlantic links? And you can't, because microwave is a line of sight. It's really point to point, and it doesn't deal well with the curvature of the Earth whereas fiber does. But a link of only 700 and some miles actually can benefit. There's a tower on top of the NASDAQ that goes up to about 200 feet, a similar one in Chicago that just gets enough around the curvature of the Earth to be able to make that high-speed link. But going back to you, is this a new area of business? Mass connection companies that are catering to financial institutions to get just that extra millisecond of competitive edge.
Okay, so yes, it works. But the reason why we haven't really started seeing this yet is because microwave equipment in the past has been inherently pretty slow. It's a lot of the latency is determined by, you know, converting it to the microwave and sending it in transceivers and so forth. And oh, by the way, when you start dealing with microwaves that can shoot that far, you're starting to deal with microwaves that are really freaking dangerous. I know a guy that I used to work with, his right arm is a hook. And it's because what he was doing is on the microwave feed horn for a communication system he was working on, he ran his hand across it because he thought, you know, it was a little warm. There's a crack in the microwave feed horn, and enough energy came out of that feed horn and cooked his arm. So microwaves are inherently dangerous, and that's one of the reasons why they're expensive, but previously they've also been slow. Now, this is the reason why. So now as microwaves are getting faster and the more sensitive, so you can drop the power so you don't need these massively dangerous microwaves anymore, we're starting to see more and more people investing in helium balloons. We're starting to see people putting in communications blimps and, basically tinkering with them to see if it's cost effective. Now, if you start thinking about that and you have a blimp that, you know, doesn't move that much and you've got the gyroscopic stabilization of antennas, now all of a sudden you've got a way of getting over the line of sight issue, but without having to go up 20,000 miles into geosynchronous orbit, which, you know, defeats the whole purpose of the microwave. So start looking at that. We're already starting to see a bunch of them, especially in the Midwest, where helium balloons are potentially viable because more predictable weather. And who knows? We might start seeing blimps circling cities that might contain microwave relays. It might contain cell phone tower equipment. You might have a lot of different things. And the blimps are getting cost effective.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Microwaves, it's not just for death rays anymore. Now, when we come back, we're going to be bringing in a good friend of mine, Mr. Glenn Evans, who is the lead architect, the lead engineer for Interop. But before that, I want to take just a bit of time to talk about one of our sponsors, and that's TechServe. Now, you know that here we are all about the enterprise, but sadly, we probably don't talk enough about Apple, which is why I love the fact that TechServe is part of the Twilight Riot, because they get Apple. They understand what it can do for the enterprise, and they understand what it could do for you. As New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and technology provider, TechServe serves creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. They carry a full range of Apple products, from iPhones and iPads to iMacs, MacBooks, iPods, and accessories. TechServe also has a range of partnerships with top vendors to facilitate flexible, efficient, and creative solutions for all your business needs. TechServe assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple, Avid, and Adobe solutions throughout the United States. Whether you are just now committed to iPads, or if it's been running in your business for a long time, from sales to support, process to practice, TechServe can help. Some amazing technology solutions are being deployed on iPads right now. If you've been to the Delta terminals in LaGuardia, Toronto, or Minneapolis, in fact, if you went through them this Thanksgiving, you may have noticed that nearly every seat in the terminal is equipped with an iPad. Travelers can now sit anywhere in the terminal and receive real-time flight updates on the iPad or use them to order food, play games, browse the internet, and check email while they're waiting. Over 1.5 million visitors used these iPads in Delta's terminals just this past year. The result has been a double-digit increase in food and beverage revenue and the highest customer satisfaction scores of all participating airports. OTG Management is the hospitality company behind Delta's terminals. They turned to TechServe to provide, configure, and install the world's largest deployment of iPads. It's a number that just keeps growing as they add new terminals. And TechServe really was the natural place to turn because they sell, support, personalize, configure, and manage massive iPad projects. It's what they do, from the Delta terminals to a school with 700 chef instructors to an operation that delivered personally configured iPads to 3,000 cable technicians. TechServe is able to do full lifecycle management for all your technology needs by providing the devices that you need, getting them up and running, teaching you and your staff how to effectively use them, and maintaining them so that they're always working efficiently. TechServe also provides ongoing support so that if your enterprise has a problem, help is never further than a phone call away. So if you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success with the world's most experienced partner? If your business is considering integrating iOS technology at your workplace, then please contact TechServe today and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. Visit techserve.com/quiet and TechServe will help you assess your current or future iPad needs and give you advice to make it a success. That's techserve.com/quiet. techserve.com/quiet. And we thank TechServe for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get to it. We welcome back to the show. He's actually been on the show over Skype, but never in studio, Mr. Glenn Evans, the lead engineer of Interop and the head of Accrue Consulting. Glenn, so good to see you.
Hi, Padre. Great to be here.
Now, for the kids at home who maybe did not see the episodes from Interop where you were guest, do you want to tell them a little bit who you are and how you came to be the lead engineer of Interop?
Sure thing. I run my own little consulting business, primarily focused on the event space, event technology, event networks, short-term temporary networks. But I started sort of in the networking game many moons ago. And around about the mid-90s, got involved with the Interop and InteropNet program as a volunteer, as a way to, let's say, enhance my career, use it as an education path. And then about 10 years ago, got transplanted into the U.S., to actually run the Interop program or the InteropNet program.
I like it. Now, you were a volunteer at the Interop program before you became the lead engineer. What drew you to Interop in the first place?
Yes, I actually volunteered around about 96, 97 back in Australia. And I think it was at that point, it was Interop and certainly the industry was growing. There were a lot of new technologies coming out. And this was one event or one venue where you could go and see a whole heap of technologies from being demonstrated within the sort of, let's say, vendor booths and also as part of the InteropNet and learn about those technologies and take them back to your day-to-day life.
What brought you into networking in the first place? I know that you've been doing it for quite a while and, you know, coming across the pond, going back over to the UK, coming back to the United States. What was it that drew you to this field?
I think, well, I actually started out life as an electrician, working in high-voltage power stations. And it was way back when things were starting to get privatized, and I sort of realized that that really wasn't going to be a long-term career choice. At that stage, you know, personal computers were coming out, so I got into the computer game. And then after about 4 or 5 years in that, we were starting to look at, you know, networks becoming a little bit more ubiquitous. Ethernet was coming out or had been stabilized and was becoming more prevalent in business, and thought, hey, this communication gig's not too bad, so I'll have a go at that, and managed to walk myself and perhaps talk myself into various organizations that sort of allowed me to progress my career, and this is where I am today.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Interop, because Interop, I think maybe I talk about it a bit too much, but it is the thing that links together everyone that's currently on this program. Brian Chee, Curtis Franklin, myself, you, I think we all met through Interop. And as you mentioned, it is one of these conferences that was built by geeks for geeks. A bunch of engineers came together in Monterey and they decided to share their code. Why was that?
Well, I think it initially started as a way for people to just try out their systems, try out their equipment and to learn. And that was the really big thing is, well, so what are you guys doing? Oh, we're doing this. How about we put the two together and see what comes out of it? And that's how that all started. And yeah, you're right. That's the sort of the common thread between or across a lot of us. Like I first ran into Cheebert, you know, 1998 or something like that. Could have been 96, actually. And I was thinking about this morning. It's probably 10 years almost to the month when we first got you involved in the InterOpNet project, when we looked at your volunteer sign-up and thought, oh, yeah, okay, we'll give him a go. And obviously we've met Curtis, you know, along the way as well through Brian. So I think one of the cool things that, while InterOp started out as a learning exercise for, you know, exhibiting companies and engineers, over time it's morphed into something where you still have that, but it's more, let's say, more relevant on a personal networking level, where you're meeting your peers, you're talking to guys who have been there, done that, or are looking at doing the next great thing.
Right. Glenn, let me ask you this. When you think about InterOp, at least the people who have been to the show, you think about the network. The network is the thing that sets InterOp from all the other conferences that try to do enterprise gear. And that's because we actually build the network using some of the enterprise gear that's at the show. Why do we do that? I mean, I know we've had discussions about this. It would be a lot cheaper and it would be probably a lot easier to just hire the convention center to give us a network. Why do we go through the trouble, through the expense of actually making a network?
I think probably the key thing is that it allows us to demonstrate to the attendee base and provide value to the attendee about the latest and greatest networking sort of technologies. You can do it a lot cheaper, a lot quicker, you know, with, let's say, standard type gear and, let's say, permanent type solutions. But, you know, the InterOpNet being a demonstration network that people can actually get their hands on and learn from is one of the key selling points.
Okay. Oh, this question is coming from the chat room. We actually have questions coming in. Weird Amy wants to know, well, once we have that network built, what do we do with it? I mean, we build it twice a year, actually four times a year, really, because we build it here in San Francisco, tear it apart, bring it to either Las Vegas or New York, build it back up there, tear it down, and bring it back. Once we've built up this network, this next generation network with all sorts of cool bells and whistles and a lot of bandwidth, exactly what are we trying to accomplish with it? I mean, is it always just faster, or are we exploring other technologies at InterOp that maybe might change the way we look at communications?
Well, I think probably the first thing we try and do with it is not break it. It is a production network. People are relying on it. But the second thing, and this is where the real challenge comes in, is, yeah, it's a transport network, but, okay, can you leverage that to demonstrate other technologies or other concepts? And that's really what we try and sort of focus on, whether it's, you know, different management systems, whether it's different ways of operating the network or controlling or programming the network. I have this sort of vision, and it's similar to where, you know, Cisco are today with the Internet of Things, in that the network is this ubiquitous, you know, transport mechanism. Think of it like, you know, the power grid or the phone grid. It's there and it just works, but it enables you to do a whole heap of other stuff. Okay, yeah, from the basic, you know, let's say, power analogy, you turn lights on. But then, okay, you can also then look at a TV studio. It runs a whole heap of power. But if the power's not there and it doesn't work and it doesn't function, it's not secure, your TV station's not going to run. And you start to think of things like that, and that's really where the power of the network is. And that's sort of the things that we're starting to try and look at now.
I got it. Brian, I want to go over to you because, of course, both of us have a lot of experience with InterOp. And going on that same question, is InterOp just a big network? I mean, do we just lay down a bunch of fiber and a bunch of copper and hook it up with a bunch of switches? Or is there something else that we're trying to do every time we create this next-gen network?
Okay, so one of the things that always attracted me to InterOp is the fact that the network is not the same every year. It actually starts off with a request for proposal that various vendors will go and respond to with their solutions. It is a solutions-based system where the vendors, say Extreme Networks, Enterasys, Cisco, this last year was Avaya, get to show off their latest and greatest, their whiz-bang widget that they think will make your life better as an enterprise buyer. It is a marketing event, but we are highlighting technology that may or may not be seen in a typical enterprise. It is unusual in that we get to do what's called a greenfield install every single year. It's as if you ripped out every single piece of networking equipment in your enterprise and started from scratch every single year. No one in their right mind would do that. But then again, many people have called us not in our right mind. But it's a great way to demonstrate how, if you were getting started, trying to do something new, this might be a great way of you trying it out. I've taken a lot of interop technologies that I've learned over the years. I got started in the Vegas 95 show. And it's gone into various other projects. There's some interop technology in the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force. There's some interop technology in the Pentagon. There's some interop technology on a few aircraft carriers, for God's sakes. Interop has been one of these amazing, amazing melting pots to cross-pollinate information, cross-pollinate knowledge. It's one of those places where I could literally be sitting in the NOC next to the person that invented the technology, for God's sakes. It's an amazing, amazing place to learn. It's an amazing place to try out new things.
Yeah, yeah. Glenn, let me go over to you because I think Chiebert makes a really good point when he calls interop a greenfield network. And I think maybe that's something that a lot of us who have done the event for such a long time have forgotten. That is, when we talk here on the show about networking, we like to bring up our 10,000-seat enterprise network. That's our sort of our golden standard of fictitious scenarios. You've got a 10,000-seat network. What do you? How do you implement X? How do you install Y? What do you do with A, B, C? With interop, we don't do that. Every year we know, look, we need to serve these customers. We need to provide these services. But how we do that is entirely up to us. The gear, the methodology, the process, the connectivity, we're going to decide the best way to do that each and every single year. And it may change each and every single year. I'm just thinking back to some of the technologies that really, I'm going to say, had a birthing spot. Maybe weren't born at, but were definitely helped along by being at interop. Things like wireless, 802.11, you know, with Symbol way back, came into interop and provided the attendees with a experience of a wireless network and really sort of changed a lot of their ideas about what was possible. We did the same thing with VoIP. We did the same thing with Xeris coming in and showing us what a more efficient wireless could do. We did the same thing with software-defined networks, where you've got some of the best and the brightest coming into the show and doing something that hadn't really been tried on that scale. So as the lead engineer, when you have this green field every time interop comes around, how do you imagine what we're going to do next?
And a lot of discussions with a lot of people. You know, I'm the first to admit, you know, I'm not the smartest guy in the room, but I know quite a few who I like to think are smart people. And it's sort of a matter of, it's a collaborative thing in that, yeah, I've sort of got the vision, I have to put it together. But the trick is taking input from a lot of people and working out what's going to be interesting to the attendee, what's going to be of value to the attendee, and more importantly, and it's probably a little, it could be either a, you know, higher or lower priority, what's going to be more important to the industry at the given time? You know, the last couple of years we have focused on software-defined networking. And we've had, you know, a lab environment where we got everybody together, and then over a period of 12 months, as SDN became a little bit more mature, we're able to show progression in that particular concept to a point where it's not quite ready for production, but it's close, or where we could, you know, willing to take a risk and put SDN elements into the production network. Maybe not a full-blown system, but certainly, you know, yeah, 45% of the network running on an SDN concept. And as Brian said, yeah, we build it based on solutions. You know, the reality is pure networking and pure transport, to some degree, it's been done by everybody and it gets a little bit boring. So we've got to try and look at things that are making, you know, networking more exciting or making the industry a little bit more exciting, and making it more attractive for the attendees and whatever to, yeah, to come along and see what we're doing.
Yeah. The chat room is talking about what is the next great thing. What's the thing that's going to change enterprise engineering? But I think Chiebert, actually, in the chat room, writes really well that one of your most valuable skills is the ability to get together a room of amazing people with very different personalities, most of the time from competing companies, companies that actually butt heads in the marketplace. Make them sit down and say, okay, putting aside your solution for a second, I know that you do this, I know that you do that, but let's figure out if you weren't working for any company, how would we want to do that? How is that possible? I mean, a lot of people are going to be really sort of cynical about this and say, look, the vendors control these shows, that the engineers actually have no say. But at Interop, the engineers actually design it the way that we want it, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And a lot of that goes to the history of Interop and the history of the InteropNet, where it's an open, collaborative environment. But it's only open to a certain degree. The vendors get in there and they're spending a lot of money providing a lot of equipment, a lot of time, a lot of manpower. You know, they don't want to walk away with a bloody nose in an open forum. So part of our management role is to make sure that that doesn't happen. And sure, yeah, no matter which vendor it is, whether it's big, small, they all have problems. They've all had challenges. And part of the goal of what we do with the InteropNet and what we do as people managers is to, let's say, manage that and make sure that what happens inside that particular group or that little group stays inside the group and that anything that comes out is a positive and not a negative.
Right, right. I know that this is... I don't think I'm spoiling anything by saying one of the first things that a volunteer to Interop will hear is what happens in the network stays in the network. And that's not a cover-up. You know, in fact, we tell people, look, when you go back to your home networks, if we've isolated an issue, feel free to use that knowledge to make your network better. But what we're essentially saying is, look, this is neutral ground. For the duration of the show, you're not competing against each other. For the duration of the show, we're trying to advance the craft, not just your company. But I'd like to touch on something that you mentioned, and I think Chibert alluded to as well, and that is the commoditization of enterprise networking. It used to be, you know, around at the beginning of Interop, that there were really some strong competing standards, that you had to pick a solution, you had to go with that, and that was where you're going to spend your money, that's where you were going to spend your resources. Nowadays, you can buy a switch from vendor X, you can buy a black box from vendor Y, you could tie it together with logistical support from vendor B, and it doesn't seem to matter. But if that's the case, if everything that we do has been commoditized, where is the fun? I'm going to use fun to say, where are the interesting things? What's the next big thing for you? What would you like to play with?
It's interesting you say that. Networking hardware and the technologies have become commoditized. But there still takes a certain amount of skill to get all that sort of stuff working together the way it's designed. If anybody's ever hit a spanning tree loop or a spanning tree problem across a large multi-vendor network, they'll probably understand what we're talking about. Even though the stuff off the shelf, you plug it together and it works, as you scale it up, you still need to have some tacit knowledge about the concepts and the technologies to make it work properly. Otherwise, when something goes wrong, it will come back to bite you. But that said, you know, where is the next big thing? And I suppose I spent half my time thinking about where the next big thing is going to come from. You know, we look at, you know, historically over the last couple of years, that whole SDN type thing has come into play. I think at the moment, from a vendor perspective, they're still picking the low-hanging fruit. So they're looking at data centers because it's quick, it's easy, and they can get their name and get their product out there. I still think transport networks and global transport networks are an ideal candidate for, you know, SDN-type technologies. Just the vendors are still working their way up to that sort of a level. So that would be one area. I think, you know, obviously, you know, BYOD, we've heard people talk about that, and, you know, the prevalence of consumer technology in the enterprise. Yeah, that's going to happen. And I think our job as enterprise and small business type networking technologists is to make that as seamless and as user-friendly as possible. But also then keep in mind that we need to look at, you know, yes, security and all those things that, you know, that corporations and companies need. And there's going to be a balance. Yep. And that's one of the things we need to look at.
Brian, let me go over to you with that. I love the fact that Glenn has identified something like global carrier networks. When we look about what the next big thing is it expanding the SDN idea, no matter what any vendor may call it? SDN is fabric from one company, or single pane of glass from another company, or global switching from another company. Do you see that as being the next big thing, being able to sit down and route traffic not just across your network, not just across your corporate network, but across the globe, being able to sit down and switch carriers the same way that you would switch your office?
Well, tell ya, Interop actually has been doing that exact thing for a heck of a long time. Not many people really and truly understand wide area network routing, and the gang that works for us actually does really well. In fact, some of the people that work with us actually helped write some of the specifications. The Interop network is constantly being tweaked during the show. Unlike a lot of corporate networks, we have to be very, very responsive to the needs of the vendors. And in a lot of cases, these vendors are doing international or global demonstrations. And the Interop network is one of the few places that they could probably get away with this. If you're going and having a network put in by a typical convention center, they're probably not going to have a full-on NOC that is probably not tweaking the BGP peering and working with the route optimization. That's another thing that makes Interop unique. But more importantly, Interop is actually a proving ground. It's a network proving ground. It's not, we follow all the trends, we look at how to demonstrate them, but we are one of the few places where vendors can take existing technology, stuff that they're just starting to ship, and prove that it works. That's really what that whole Interop design process is. We're proving that, yes, SDN can work on a really large network. There's been a few surprises along the way. You know, one of our good friends, when they first started doing Interop, got really, really surprised the first time their main switch had to handle a /8 routing domain. We actually killed the switch, and they sat back, scratched their head, and go, oh, wow, okay, we kind of underestimated how much space we needed. Let's go and redesign that. And the nice thing is there's been a lot of people trading information back and forth. Competitors leave their egos at the door for the most part. And it's fairly common to have Interop engineers sitting side by side wearing competitors' T-shirts working on source code together. Now, try to see about doing that in any other venue. It just doesn't happen. Interop is unique. Interop is absolutely amazing. And this is the reason why I actually give up close to a month of my year working on Interop, both at Hot Stage for Las Vegas and Hot Stage for New York, and also the shows themselves. It's a huge, huge time commitment, and I'm a volunteer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think maybe that should be the show title. Interop is unique. I should mention that, Curtis Franklin hasn't gone away. He is still here. He is messaging us that right now his DSL connection is being port scanned. It's probably being attacked, which is why he had to drop out. We're trying to get him back via another means, but unfortunately, we have no control over his upstream. Now, when we come back, we're going to have a little discussion with our guest, with Glenn Evans, about the future of networking. You're definitely going to want to stick around for that. But before that, let's take a moment to thank another one of our sponsors. And of course, that's RingCentral. Now, you know the story. When Leo built this brick house, he decided that we were going to do what we were telling our audience to do. We were going to go into the cloud. We put our mail in the cloud. We put our document sharing in the cloud. We put our scheduling in the cloud. So when our IT guy, Russell, told us that we could put our phone system in the cloud, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. We get the full PBX functionality without a big, clunky phone system sitting in the basement. No wires running to every corner of the building. No one who is dedicated to handle the configuration of our PBX. It's all done through one simple interface. Zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling. Our producers can get their voicemail through their emails, and we can even get our fax messages right on our smartphones. RingCentral also features call functioning, Program the order of devices that will ring when someone calls your number, like your desk phone, then your smartphone, so that you never miss an important business opportunity again. You can even choose the amount of rings before the call goes to the next device. It's all part of that creative solution from RingCentral. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to try RingCentral. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Once again, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to it, Glenn. So we've talked a little bit about Interop. We've talked about how you came to Interop. We talked a little bit about how Interop is constructed each year and the green field that is the geek summer camp of the Interop Net. But let's talk a little bit about how Interop can affect, let's say, the larger world at hand. There's a story here from Network World talking about the closing of the deal between Enterasys and Extreme. Now, you and I and Chibert actually have really good knowledge of this because we've worked with both Extreme and Enterasys in the Interop Net. So we are very intimately knowledgeable of their gear, of their capacities. Well, they inked a deal not too long ago where Extreme bought Enterasys. Together, they have something like 3.2, 3.4, depending on how you count, percent of the network sales across the world. Of course, the gorilla in the room being Cisco with about 60%, and then 30% shared between HP and Huawei, and everyone else fighting for that last 10% or so. But tell me, why did this deal happen, and what potential ramifications does it have for networking? Because both of these companies have interesting ways of looking at enterprise-class networking.
Yeah, well, I think probably one of the key things to look at there is, you know, as you mentioned with the statistics, you know, Cisco owns 60 to 70% of the enterprise market. So the rest of the vendors are fighting for that remaining percentage. And the only way to sort of get any growth in the industry is to either come up with a really, a really cool technology or go out and buy somebody. And that's essentially what's happened here. Now, the funny thing was it's Extreme buying Enterasys. If we look back 4 or 5 years ago when Extreme essentially got out of making their own silicon and started to buy, you know, Broadcom chipsets, we thought, okay, they're done. Yes, they're going to be a buyout target. But they managed to hold on, and primarily through their Exos operating system, which was a pretty cool type system, Linux-based, modular, start and stop services on the fly. It was great. You know, up until probably 2 months ago, we still had Extreme gear, you know, in our warehouse and running some of our critical networks. But I think what the Enterasys model was was slightly different. It was a programmable model based around network access control. So it was a secure way of building and designing networks. Everything was centrally managed. You'd push out your configs. And for a corporate environment, certainly, and yeah, secure education type facilities, healthcare, whatever, was a great system. For us, you know, in a temporary network, there were some challenges we had to work around. So I think the purchase of Enterasys by Extreme gives them that software-based model and that secure networking-type model that will allow them to, sort of, let's say, build, add to their portfolio and provide a more compelling story in some of these vertical markets.
All right. Curtis, I want to go over to you. Welcome back, by the way. Hopefully you're not being attacked anymore. Something that Glenn mentioned about Enterasys and Extreme coming together is they both bring something that they're very good at. Enterasys was probably the avowed master of network access control. Their entire model was based on this idea of policy. You build a policy and it deploys across your network. In fact, it's one of the first real functional things that look like software-defined networking today. Why should I have to reconfigure every switch where I could say this user should have these kind of privileges and that propagates across my entire network? So they do NAC, and Extreme has always been known for speed and for the maturity of their operating system. It's even 10 years ago, it was better. It was easier to use. It was more transparent than some of the more modern operating systems that we see in switches today. So together, how do you see an enterprise looking at them as a competitive buy?
Well, it seems to me that the story that they've got to tell really does rest on these two legs. You've got the speed and the capabilities that lead you in the direction, as you said, of software-defined networking. One of the concerns that I've heard people express about things like software-defined networking is the performance hit that you're likely to take. Now, just a while ago, we talked about how much a company was willing to spend in order to shave milliseconds off transaction time. While most companies don't need to do that, they are concerned about that overall transaction time. So the idea that they can add functionality, can make things more modern, more controllable, a better utilization of existing network infrastructure without suffering a huge performance penalty, is a compelling argument. Now, going against this is, as you point out, that huge gorilla sitting over there with a Cisco label on it because it has the benefit of familiarity. This is a slight exaggeration, but let's face it. You could almost go down to a corner lot in a city where day laborers meet and find a Cisco admin. Just all kinds of people know how to program, at least to a certain degree, a Cisco router. Getting someone who is good at Extreme or the Enterasys operating system is rather more difficult, and that translates into rather more expensive. Put them together, though, and I think what the two companies have done is make themselves together a much more compelling story than either one of them was apart. And that's really the heart of a great deal.
Right, right. Chibert, I want to throw something over to you. And, you know, I'm probably going to offend a lot of people, but that's okay. That's kind of what I do. We talk a lot about some amazing breakthroughs in networking technology that we really like, you know, faster switches and lower latency switches and better ways to manage. And at Interop, we've got a chance to play with some of these vendors, everything from Enterasys to Juniper. But as we mentioned at the beginning of the story, their percentage of the market is actually tiny. It's minuscule. Cisco is still what everybody buys. So my question to you is, you know, as an IT administrator, and Curtis, you as a person who knows the mind of the IT executive, even as good as some of these solutions are, they're never going to be more than niche, right? I mean, I think the adage still holds. No one ever got fired for buying Cisco.
Yeah, except keep in mind, one thing that a lot of people keep forgetting is Enterasys actually owned a massive amount of government sales. Enterasys had some good technology. It had some secure technology. And for the longest time, Enterasys was one of the leaders in the federal sales, especially DoD sales. Cisco was actually playing catch-up. But Enterasys kind of lost their way for a little while, and their technology suffered for it. Well, Extreme has always been really good at that. And it's not so much that they're fast, it's that they're fast at layer 3 and layer 4. That is a big difference. Their systems have been radical in that they were one of the first people to have gig switches that had an equal command line and web GUI. They kind of led the way in that one. Cisco, still, most of the time, you need to be in iOS. You need to be in the command line. And the other thing, too, is Enterasys had a really big advantage in that they were a consistent product line. The commands that would work on one portion of the Enterasys line would work on another. That's one of the reasons why they're able to have that centralized command and control structure that Cisco has been able to do to a certain point, but there's still some gotchas in there. Anyone that's had to do a cross balance across for VoIP across the Cisco routed network knows all about what I'm talking about. So what we have is we actually have some really good solutions getting together, and maybe, just maybe, we can give our friends with the big C a run for their money on certain market niches.
I like it. Now, we do have to draw to a close very soon here, but I do want to touch one more topic, because Glenn, you kind of alluded to this when you talked about the next big thing, this idea of a globally managed network, something that's a bit better than what we're running with BGP right now. But there's something that we've touched on this show before anytime we talk about a globally managed network, and that is, how do you globally manage a network when so many countries now seem to want to fragment? They want to break off. There's a balkanization of the internet that's taking place with countries like India and Iran and China and Brazil, even friendlier countries that are saying, well, you know what? We want to break off our section of the internet. We want to give you a gateway, and we want to be able to do inside whatever it is that we want to do without interference from you. That doesn't seem to be in line with this idea of A, the Internet of Things, and B, a network that is a single pane of glass for the entire world, these carrier-switched networks that I could control. Interop is an interesting use case for that, because it used to be a huge Class A and plus network. What would your view be of this global spanning network? Are we heading to it? Are we heading away from it? What's the future for those who want to control their own networks?
Oh, that's a really tricky one. I think, you know, my basic perspective on, you know, the internet and internet operations is, you know, probably goes back to the original sort of edict of the interop of, you know, interop and the internet is, you know, do no evil. Yeah, do your own little thing, but, you know, just do no evil. Make sure you're being a good corporate citizen. And, yeah, as part of that, yeah, we gave back our slash 8, yeah, and, yeah, when IPv4 was sort of running really low. But I sort of look at this and this whole geopolitical type thing and think of it, you know, try and simplify it a little bit. It's really no different from a corporation having their own, you know, internet use policy. Yeah, countries are trying to do the same. And I think as, you know, more countries come online and become more savvy with, let's say, what's going on, they're going to realise that, hey, listen, yeah, this we need to do this to protect our citizens for whatever reason, if that's their case. But I also then sort of think, well, hang on, should we really get involved with all this? Should we just worry about ourselves and just let these guys do their thing, as long as what they're doing doesn't affect us, under that sort of whole do no evil type principle? It's an interesting one. I could play devil's advocate on both sides, but I think, yeah, at the end of the day, the whole internet was, yeah, okay, came out of ARPA, and, you know, it's essentially US controlled. And I think perhaps some countries are sort of starting to realise, well, hang on, that's probably maybe not in our best interest, particularly considering, you know, what some of the, let's say, the three-letter acronym agencies are doing with the internet and with some of the information that's transiting the internet. You know, there's also talk about, you know, some countries bypassing North America altogether for any transit to and from other countries. Yeah, is that practical? Yeah, it probably is, but somebody needs to spend a whole heap of money, and that, you know, I don't think is going to happen, not in the near term.
I want to go over to you first, Curtis, because Glenn actually brings up a really, really good point here, and I think he has just summarized something that the three of us have talked about whenever we've been talking about network spying, about what the NSA is doing, what the United States government is doing, where our view has been, well, of course they're doing that. As enterprise network people, we know that the capabilities are very easy. They're actually baked into the hardware to be able to do that kind of traffic management, spying, whatever you want to call it. I think Glenn's taking it one step further. He's saying, look, at its core, there's no difference between an enterprise and a country. It's just scale, right? One network is bigger than the other. If you take away the geopolitical issues, which you really should when you're talking about network, what's the difference between an enterprise down the street saying, we don't think our employees should use Facebook on the clock, and a country saying, we don't think anyone should use Twitter?
Well, from a practical standpoint, from a network management standpoint, there is no difference. I have done work for companies in the past who started out doing network security devices for U.S. government agencies, moved their marketing to large corporations, and I know that they were involved in providing capabilities to certain foreign governments that use them in ways that in North America we tend not to approve of. How could it be that way? Because the task was the same. The only difference was the overall bandwidth and the number of simultaneous connections. You know, once you can scale those, you can control a country, as you said, about as easily as you can control an enterprise. And when you talk about some of our very large enterprises and some of our smaller countries, the differences go away completely. The question really is one of management practices and of the philosophy of managing a network. And that's really the subject for an entirely different show. But from the practical router jockey level, it's all one big network.
Now, Schubert, I want to go over to you because I think maybe you might give us an opposing, maybe even a devil's advocate side to this. We're essentially saying, look, you're a user on a network and you have to live by whatever rules that network administrator gives to you. But is there something else? I mean, is there that old spirit of the internet that Carl talked about that maybe never really existed, where a citizen of the internet has certain inalienable rights that should transcend geopolitical / corporate exertion of power on these networks?
Oh, there's certainly going to be some basic freedoms that people want, freedom of speech and so forth. And the unfortunate thing is what we're really starting to talk about are business rules, whether the business rules are applied at a national level or whether they're applied at a corporate level. Keep in mind that if you are a employee of a corporation, you have agreed in essence to their acceptable use policy. If you are a citizen of a country, you have implicitly agreed to comply with the laws. So it's just a matter of, are you complying with business rules? To answer you directly, yes, I think there should be some basics in there. Otherwise, we're going to have a very Orwellian society. There should be some things in there about truth. There should be some things in there about the burden of proof and things like that. It's not that much different from the laws that we've agreed to. Yes, I think enterprises need to say, for instance, be a little bit more transparent on some of the things they're doing. But in when it comes down to it, and a corporation is not a democracy. You have the ability to walk out that door if you really want to. But in the end, the management of that corporation are the rulers of that organization, and it is your choice whether or not you're going to comply with it. But if you choose not to comply with it, there's the door.
Nice. I like that. Glenn, I want to give you the last word here. This is it. We've got a really good discussion going on in the chat room, but maybe we can save that for the post show. Instead, what I want to ask you is, in your experience as the lead architect of Interop, as the lead engineer, as the guy who has chosen what goes into the green field, the man who sees these global carrier networks as the next big thing, where do you want to be positioned? I mean, I see you as a visionary of the enterprise class networks because you actually get to be vendor neutral. You get to sit back from the gear and you get to say, I like the solution. I like the solution. What's the next solution that you like? I kind of sprung that on you. So,
apart from sitting on a beach in the south of France or south of Spain, sipping sangria and tapas, I think smarter management, sort of policy type stuff would be where I'd probably position myself. And also I think with 11AC wireless coming out, somewhere in that sort of wireless space would be quite interesting as well. You know, the basic transport, it's always going to be there, but I think that's where the ubiquity's got to come into it. But it's the control and management monitoring is really where, you know, I think the interesting stuff's going to come out.
Control and management. I like that. Maybe that should be our show title. Well, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang podcast on the internet. And yeah, I pulled 9 out of 10 nuns, confirmed that that's true. Now, I do want to take a moment to thank all the panelists. Thank you so very much for being here. Of course, Brian Chi, let's start with you for being part of TWiET for what? A year and a half now? What, 69 episodes? That's kind of crazy.
Now, I've only missed a few episodes.
Yeah.
Usually because I'm traveling.
And actually, you're going to be traveling. You're going to be in studio next week. So tell us where the TWiET Riot can follow you.
Well, I've got what? I think I'm all the way up to, I think, 700 followers now on Twitter. I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. Toss me a tweet, toss me a follow. I'll be more than happy to answer questions. Shout out to Devin Mudd, Detective Mudd looks like he's going to be vacationing in Hawaii. Ooh. Look forward to tipping back a cold one with you, Detective.
Oh, and by the way, yeah, you should know that the TWiET fans who have gone to Hawaii have had a blast visiting T-Bird. So if you're ever thinking about taking a vacation, be sure to drop the big guy a line. Or to the other big guy on the other coast who was saved by Google Hangouts. Curtis, what are you doing at Enterprise Efficiency? Where can the TWiET Riot find you?
Well, getting ready this week to head to Austin next week. While all of you are sitting there in the Brick House, I'm going to be in Austin, Texas, getting ready for Dell World, doing that. So it should be interesting. If any of the TWiET Riot's going to be in Austin next week, would love to catch up with you there. You can follow me on Twitter, KG4GWA. You can follow me on Google Plus. Or if you have an interesting story that you think other people would like to hear, if you are an executive who would be willing to share some of your hard-won knowledge, would love to talk to you, please drop me an email, franklin@enterpriseefficiency.com. I would love to chat with you.
I love it. And, of course, our special in-studio guest, Mr. Glenn Evans. Glenn, it is always a pleasure to see you. You're a mate, and not just a mate, you're a good man and a fantastic technologist. Tell us, can the TWiET Riot find you? How should they look at what your next work is? I know that you've been working a bit with Microsoft on a little launch. Are you allowed to talk about that?
Yeah, sure, yeah. Obviously, Microsoft have just launched their Xbox One console with a launch in LA and New York simultaneous launch, LA, New York, London last week. I've been on a roadshow for them for the last 3 or 4 weeks, various cities, introducing the console to the gaming world. So finishing up that one this week in Philadelphia at the Eagles versus Lions game, I think.
And then, oh, you have such a hard life.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be cold. I'm not looking forward to that. And then I've got the rest of the year off. But Twitter account is GoAcrew, GoAcrux. And then I start back on Interop in January next year.
Fantastic. Always a pleasure. We're going to have you back, if not just for Interop, for another episode, because it's always good to have another perspective on the enterprise world. Now, I want you to know that I love you. That's right. The viewers, the listeners, the people who make this show possible, well, I want to give you something back. Just because it's Thanksgiving, just because it's the holiday season, just because you're you. And what I want to give you is a way to get TWiET on every device of choice. If you go to our show page right now at twit.tv/TWiET, you'll find a drop-down menu with all the different ways that you can have every episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech dropped into your device of choice automatically, onto your iPod, onto your iPad, into your PC, your Mac, your Android phone, or tablet. We give it all because, well, we give our all for you. Look, there's me with a Sonic wall box. Go figure. Also, did you know that we've got a YouTube page? Yeah, you know what? The community is slowly growing, and we have a few things planned for the new year, so you're definitely going to want to follow because it's going to get exciting. Go to youtube.com/Twiat. There you'll be able to find not just all of our episodes, but also the individual segments. If there was a Stuff My IT Guy Said that you wanted to see, or something from the data closet, or a pro gear, a pro tip segment, well, you're going to find it. You'll be able to watch it. You'll be able to get yourself learned. Also, please, please follow me on Twitter. I love having Twitter followers because I get to tell them what's going to be next on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Not only will you find out what's going up on Twiat, but you'll be able to communicate with me. You can tell me what you want to see on the show. You can tell me what topics you want to hear about. You can tell me what guests you want us to invite. So please follow at Padre SJ. Also, you could watch us live every week. That's right. This show happens live every Monday at noon Pacific time. Go to live.twit.tv, and there you'll be able to see not just this show, but the pre-show and the post-show. You get to see how the sausage is made. More importantly, you get to be part of the growing experiment that is twit.tv. And as long as you want to be part of that experiment, why not drop into our chat room at irc.twit.tv? There you will find all the most brilliant engineers, some of the funniest trolls, and you'll actually be able to talk to me during the show. You may have noticed that I pulled questions and comments out of the chat room. It's part of the give and take that is the Twiat Riot. Also, I want to thank you for joining us at our Twit TV survey, twit.tv/survey, where we need you. We need your help to help us program Twit better. We need you to tell us how you watch our shows, which shows you watch, and how you prefer to consume them. I know we're all saying that, hey, surveys are boring, but this is one of the ways that we can custom tailor our programming for you. So please, if you've got 5 minutes, drop on by twit.tv/survey. I want to thank CyberDog in the chat room, who is also an Interop alumni, for, helping us out with the show notes. And next week, we've got Kingston coming in to talk about responsibly protecting your data if you're a business traveler. Until then, I'm Father Robert, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.
You forgot your third sponsor. Just saying.
I know. No, seriously. Put a bug.
No. I was totally kidding.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by JasonHowellIsAwesome.com. If you thought he was awesome before, just wait till you see him now. For a free 30-day trial, go to JasonHowellIsAwesome.com and use our promo code JasonHowellIsAwesome.
Thanks.